the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Are we promised prosperity? You ever thought about that? We've kind of taken prosperity for granted. I just published an article on my website asking that question, are we promised prosperity? There's a lot to talk about there. Because even as Congress has now adopted this economic bailout plan and President Bush is poised to sign it, we've got to look at the basic issue that is Christians. We can't take prosperity for granted. Not only that, we got to be very, very clear. The material prosperity is not what is promised in the gospel of Jesus Christ. We're going to be looking at some of the twists and turns of that issue. I would invite you to go to my website at albertmohler.com. Look at the article, Are We Promised Prosperity? There's a lot to talk about there, and we're going to get to that conversation in just a moment. But here's the bottom line, and here's where I want to invite your calls. I want to invite you to talk about this. Do you think that prosperity is the sign of God's favor? Do you think that prosperity is what we are to expect in this life? And if not, what do we do with prosperity when we have it? The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know, out there, here's the argument in my article. Out there are a lot of folks we know who have fallen prey to a false gospel called the prosperity gospel, or they've fallen prey to a false theology, prosperity theology. But here's my concern. There are an awful lot of people who would never fall for prosperity theology, who would never go for the corruption of the gospel into a prosperity gospel, who have kind of backed into the same thing by assuming that prosperity is our right. We're going to be talking about that today on the Albert Mohler Program. Again, to join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Here's a headline that ought to have your attention. Boys do better when they are taught by men. Now, that is something that probably ought to have our attention because it's kind of one of those no-kidding moments. You start looking at that and you realize that as Christians, we've got to look at things differently than other people look at them. And right now, gender issues represent one of those lines of debate in this culture where it's pretty clear that right now, political correctness means there aren't supposed to be any differences between boys and girls. There aren't supposed to be any differences between men and women. Any differences that are there are supposed to be evidence of oppression or patriarchalism or some pattern of bad thinking. But as Christians, we have to understand that men and women are made for each other and that males and females have distinctive roles in society, in the church, in the home. And what you have here is about learning. This is from The Independent in London. It says boys will perform better in education if they have a male teacher in their primary school. According to research published today, a study of more than 1,000 men reveals almost half of them cited male primary school teachers as having had the most impact on them during their school life. In addition, 35% said having a male teacher challenged them to work harder at school. 22% said males had boosted their confidence and their own ability. Now, one of the reasons why this has the attention of the secular press is not really so much about trying to figure out the impact of the answer of why boys do better when they're taught by men, but it's simply the realization that there are so few men going into teaching as a profession. So what we have noticed not only in Great Britain, but of course here in the United States, is that teaching, especially at the primary level, but teaching as a whole, has become a primarily female activity. Female teachers vastly outnumber male teachers at the undergraduate, that is the primary and secondary school level. And that is because somehow we have reduced teaching from what it was seen to be even, say, a century ago. Back in the early part of the 20th century, you would not have seen it that way because teaching would have been understood as a primary profession the way that unfortunately has been sidelined very much now. But it is interesting you look at this and there's just a basic fact of life. Now, for instance, here is an advisor who's brought in to analyze this data. Now get this. So I assume that this fellow was paid for this analysis, but my guess is you could give it for free. Okay, here's his analysis. Listen. Male primary school teachers can often be stable and reliable figures in the lives of children they teach. End quote. No kidding. You know, the reality is that boys are looking for models. And anyone who's been around boys knows that that they respond to men differently than to women. And conversely, you could quickly come to the understanding that girls are looking for models, and they are, guess what? They're primarily looking to women for those models. Now, you can consider that evidence of some kind of bad pattern of thinking, of oppression and patriarchalism, or you can look at that as evidence of just the way things are and the way things are probably supposed to be. Now, sometimes a boy is going to latch onto a wrong model. Sometimes there's not going to be a healthy model there for him. Sometimes a girl's going to latch onto a wrong model. Sometimes there's not a healthy model for her. But more likely, the model's lacking among the boys rather than among the girls. And there are all kinds of reasons for that as well. But that headline is just one of those moments where you just look at that and say, someone was paid to do this study. Someone was paid to analyze it. Someone was reached to comment on it. And they're all saying things we basically all already know. And when there's a headline that shouts something you already know, it probably means it's something other people find shocking. There's a lot going out on there in the terms of the fronts of various life where we are raising kids and educating kids and all the same. But when it comes to a lot of busy kids, it turns out that things aren't always what they appear. The Washington Post is reporting that a lot of kids with very busy schedules are doing well. And I want to look a little closer at this because the headline certainly caught my attention. Here's the headline. For some busy kids, it's all good. Studies show children aren't necessarily stressed out by their schedules. Okay, now that's a kind of headline that's going to tell us some things a lot of families want to hear, that kids can be involved in multiple activities and can be doing all kinds of things and being in soccer and, you know, going to the this class and the that class and being involved in this activity and that activity, and they can have it all. And here's the headline that says, studies show children aren't necessarily stressed out. Here is the headline followed by the first paragraph. The paragraph is, a new wave of research into the lives of middle-class children bucks conventional wisdom and concludes they are not the overscheduled, frazzled generation that many believe them to be, end quote. So if all you have is the headline in that first paragraph, you're going to say, well, maybe we've kind of missed the point. Maybe these families aren't as stressed as they appear to be. Maybe these kids are going to do well. But let me tell you, there's another part of the story, and you probably already figured out there must be. Here's the last part of the headline. Their parents, comma, on the other hand, and it turns out that the study says that even though the kids appear to be handling the stress pretty well, the parents are absolutely frazzled. Now, here's the deal. You're only one kid. But if you're a parent, you may have more than one kid. If you're a child, you can upload all your frustration. If you're a child, you don't have to worry about getting yourself much of anywhere. It's the person who has to get you there that has to worry about it. You're not worried about juggling the meal, juggling getting the laundry done, juggling getting all the rest of life done, job at work and all the rest. It's the parent who's worried about that. So I want to come back and say, what does this story tell me? This story tells me that we increasingly live in a child-centric universe in which the study is whether the children are stressed. And I'm not saying that's an unimportant question. I'm just saying that when the study comes back and says the children aren't stressed but the parents are, guess what? Those kids are going to be stressed in some way. And when you start thinking about family life, if you look at what the study actually says, it turns out that families really are frazzled, that the families really are overcommitted. And when kids get overcommitted, it does have some very, very bad effects upon the family. It comes out and says that the researchers thought that it would have all kinds of bad effects upon the kids. Looks like the kids are handling it pretty well. But what about the family? It's just one of those reminders to us that when you see a research report, you better look a little bit below the surface, and you better not trust the headlines when this kind of thing is announced in public. Folks, I want to tell you what to watch over this weekend. Saturday, Ground Zero is Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because there the Episcopal Diocese of Pittsburgh is going to be voting on whether to secede from the Episcopal Church in the United States. The big issue there, of course, is a theological controversy within the Episcopal Church U.S., as that church has defied all calls from the Anglican Communion to repent of its action in electing and consecrating an openly gay bishop and then pushing that agenda to the breaking point. Just a matter of a few days ago, the former bishop of the Diocese of Pittsburgh, Robert W. Duncan, was removed from his office. He has called for the diocese to leave the Episcopal Church U.S., and now tomorrow, this diocese will make a vote. All it takes, by the way, is a bare majority vote, and my guess is they're going to get it. They will follow the example set by the Diocese of the San Joaquin in California that has already voted to secede, and then all of this is thrown into courts because the Episcopal Church U.S. says it's going to sue for all that property. Folks, it just reminds me of something that we should have learned in church history a long time ago. The property is not what's important. The treasure of the faith is. And I hope that those who hold by the gospel will stand by the gospel, even if it means the loss of bricks and mortar. Let's pray for the Episcopal Diocese of Pittsburgh as it's making a huge decision. Ground zero tomorrow, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. By the time we talk again, we'll know. May God glorify himself in his church. We'll be back for conversation on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Well, Congress has now passed the economic bailout plan. It heads to the White House for signature, and President Bush is expected to sign it over the weekend, and thus in time for the international and domestic markets to have that knowledge as they open on Monday. But is the crisis over? Not by a long shot. And after all, no one's actually sure exactly what's going on here. But I will tell you this, you're going to have one pattern that you can absolutely rely on, and that is that all parties involved will claim credit if it appears to work, and they will deny blame if it worsens as a crisis. Though the primary problem is a crisis in the credit markets and the financial sector, the entire economy is feeling the crunch, and the crisis may now lie in awareness of uncertainty. And markets don't like uncertainty, and consumers don't like uncertainty. No one likes uncertainty when it comes to matters economic. And there's more bad news as well. Perhaps you've heard today already that the state of California, its Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, has announced that it's facing the need for a bailout, potentially $7 billion. And get this, the state of California isn't a bad credit risk. It's doing just fine repaying its credit. It just can't get any because of constriction in the credit markets. And thus it may need a $7 billion. That's 1%, by the way, of roughly of what was adopted today. In terms of a bailout, there's going to be more bad news. Now, trying to put this into perspective is difficult, but I want us to think about one specific angle on this, and it's going to take me just a little bit to kind of get this out there in front of us. First of all, I want to point to an article published at Time Magazine today. It's by Niall Ferguson, one of the world's most influential historians. He puts a lot of this into perspective. His article is entitled The End of Prosperity. He argues that another Great Depression, what he calls a Depression 2.0, is avoidable. It's not necessary. But he does say that a period of far less material prosperity is almost surely at hand. I want to read to you two paragraphs from what he wrote. And I want to tell you, if you pay attention to these two paragraphs, you're going to have a different understanding of what's going on in this economic crisis. Paragraph number one, the U.S., not to mention Western Europe, is in the grip of a downward spiral that financial experts call deleveraging. Having accumulated debts, that is, debts beyond what is sustainable, households and financial institutions are being forced to reduce them. The pressure to do so results from a decline in the price of the assets they bought with the money they borrowed. It's a vicious feedback loop. When families and banks tip into bankruptcy, more assets get dumped on the market, driving prices further down and necessitating more deleveraging. This process now has so much momentum that even $700 billion in taxpayers' money may not suffice to stop it. Period. That's the first paragraph. Now, I haven't come across any one paragraph that had that much simple explanation of what's going on anywhere until I read Niall Ferguson's statement there. And by the way, Niall Ferguson is a world-class historian, and one of the things that is unique about him is that he's an historian of matters economic, and he really deals with this kind of stuff, and he does know how to make it succinct, doesn't he? He said, look, here's the bottom line. People borrowed money, and the stuff they borrowed the money to buy isn't now worth as much as when they borrowed the money. Thus, they're having problems paying it back. And it's a bad feedback loop because when people declare bankruptcy, then you take the housing market. The more houses that go on the market, the worse is the price slide. And that just makes sense. So Niall Ferguson is saying, just brace yourself. This isn't all doom and gloom. This is a warning. He's just saying there's going to be a lot less capital out there. There's going to be a lot less credit out there until the market absorbs all of this loss. Okay, that's paragraph number one. But brace yourself for paragraph number two. And see if this doesn't hit a little closer to home. Here's paragraph number two. In the case of households, debt rose from about 50% of gross domestic product in 1980 to a peak of 100% in 2006. In other words, households now owe as much as the entire U.S. economy can produce in a year. Much of the increase in debt was used to invest in real estate. The result was a bubble. At its peak, average U.S. house prices were rising at 20% a year. Then, as bubbles always do, it burst. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index of house prices in 20 cities has been falling since February of 2007. And the decline is accelerating. In June, prices were down 16% compared with a year earlier. In some cities, like Phoenix and Miami, they have fallen by as much as a third from their peaks. The U.S. real estate market hasn't faced anything like this since the Depression, and the pain is not over. Credit Suisse predicts that 13% of U.S. homeowners with mortgages could end up losing their homes, end quote. Okay, there is, in one paragraph, the most ominous, but I think very accurate warning that I've yet come across. And that final sentence saying that 13% of U.S. homeowners with mortgages could end up losing their homes, that's frightening. You're talking about a lot of people we will know. You're talking about a lot of people that may be listening to this program. Talking to an enormous sector of the American populace. And there's a lot of grief and concern and anxiety there. And I understand that. And I know that uncertainty is not good for the markets. I'll tell you this, uncertainty is not good for an individual. It's not good for a family. But as Christians, we have to think about this differently than others will think. And I want to go back to what Niall Ferguson says in this paragraph about debt. We are now told that households hold debt as much as 100% of the gross domestic product produced by this economy in a year. Folks, that's unsustainable. That means that if we did nothing but pay off debt for a year, that's what it would take to get there. And that means nothing else. That means starving. That means going naked. That means having nothing, buying nothing else. That means doing nothing but paying debt. It would take an entire year of the economy functioning at peak to pay that off. And that won't happen. It's not going to happen. So we're looking at a real problem here. But how should Christians think differently about this? Let me raise two issues here. Number one, credit. Going into debt. You know, for years, Christian financial counselors have been running programs on how to get out of debt. And you don't have to offer programs on how to get out of debt unless there are millions of Christians who are in debt and in all kinds of the wrong kinds of debt. And the unavoidable reduction of debt is going to be traumatic at every level. Excessive and unsustainable valuations led to bad decisions and the illusion of free money. It never lasts. The deleveraging we are now witnessing will take some time to run its course, and that course is still very much unpredictable. All right, let's think about what this means in terms of Christian theology. Time Magazine's David Van Bima has another article in Time having to deal with this, and this is what he says. Here's his article, Did God Want You to Get That Mortgage? Here's how he starts. He says, has the so-called prosperity gospel turned its followers into some of the most willing participants and hence victims of the current financial crisis? That's what a scholar of the fast-growing brand of Pentecostal Christianity believes. While researching a book on black televangelism, says Jonathan Walton, a religion professor at the University of California, Riverside, he realized that prosperity's central premise that God would make a way for poor people to enjoy the better things in life had developed an additional toxic expression during the subprime boom. Walton says that this encouraged congregants who got dicey mortgages to believe God caused the bank to ignore my credit score and blessed me with my first house. The results, he says, were disastrous because they pretty much turned parishioners into prey for greedy brokers. Lee Grady, editor of Charisma Magazine, said this, it definitely goes on that a preacher might say, if you give this offering, God will give you a house. And if they did get the house, people did think that it was an answer to prayer when in fact it was really bad banking policy. Folks, we got to talk about this. Give me a call at 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. There some have been holding on. Bless you. We'll be right back to get to your calls. We need to talk about this because this is now not just economics as if anything is just economics. This is theology. This lands on our plate. Does our theology, not just prosperity theology, does our understanding of the Christian faith imply that people should assume this kind of debt to buy a house and assume that if they get it, it's God's blessing? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I think this issue of prosperity theology is going to hit a lot of Christians just as a fundamental wake-up call. I hope so. Because it should be embarrassing to us that Time Magazine is the one doing the exposing here. David Van Beem is an outstanding reporter, and he looks at the whole issue of prosperity theology, and he goes right into some of these churches where, as Lee Grady, the editor of Charisma Magazine, which is really the most famous magazine in the charismatic movement, as he says, it definitely goes on that a preacher might say, if you give this offering, God will give you a house. And if you did get the house, people did think that it was an answer to prayer, when in fact it was really bad banking policy. In other words, prosperity theology was used to tell people that God would give them prosperity and give them a house. And in this case, Lee Grady is really clear by saying that some of them said, if you give to this offering, then God's going to give you a house. So then they went to apply for a mortgage they shouldn't have had, and they got it. The subprime mortgage crisis meant people that didn't qualify for mortgages financially were given them just on the assumption that they might be able to pay. And by the way, some of the fat cats got fat by writing mortgages they knew weren't any good. That's the really insidious part of the subprime crisis in terms of those who got rich. The other insidious part is that a lot of people are going to lose homes and are losing them even now when they got themselves into a situation in which they didn't qualify for a mortgage, but they were given one anyway. And Lee Grady says in some cases it was because preachers told them that God would give them a house. And then when they qualified when they shouldn't have, they just assumed it was God who was giving them a house when it turns out it was bad banking policy. All right, that's part of the equation. The other part of the equation is I think that many of us who wouldn't ever buy into a prosperity theology like that have backed into one of our own that simply says, if God's blessing's on you, you're going to be rich. You're going to have things. You're going to enjoy prosperity. And when the bubble bursts, if that's your theology, you're going to be in big trouble. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK from Kirkwood, New York. Gene's listening on XM170. What do you think, Gene?
Well, I think, Dr. Mohler, that you do a wonderful job, and I really do appreciate listening to you. This whole point of being rewarded by giving a gift to God is nothing more than the things that Jesus warned us about. These are false teachers.
Now, let me ask you a question, Gene. Just in terms of the prosperity theology, I think you're right on. They are false teachers. Let me ask a little closer to home. Do you think, though, that a lot of evangelicals have kind of bought into this, through the back door, just kind of backed into the idea that if God loves you, you're going to be prosperous?
Yeah, this is another example of how the great adversary works on our minds to help us distort the teachings of the Bible. We have examples in the Bible of people who were prospered after they obeyed God and did as he commanded of the person or of the nation of Israel. And so you take that and you twist it around a little bit and you turn it into, you know, obey God and give this donation to our church. And guess what? You'll get that house or you'll get that job or you'll get that car.
That's right. It doesn't work
like that. It just doesn't work like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't work like that. You're exactly right, Gene. And it doesn't work like that, especially in the gospel of Christ. In other words, reading the Old Testament, there's not a prosperity theology there. There's a God-blessing theology that was given to God's covenant people saying that if you obey, good things will happen to you. Those good things will often take the shape of material blessings. But it wasn't promised as an if-then, and it was never promised as the sum total of God's hopes. And in the gospel of Christ, we're given what can't be bought and what can't be bankrupted, what can't be taken away. But Christians from the New Testament onward have had virtually nothing. Even the disciples themselves, they were not rich. They never had prosperity. They had far more than that. Let's go to Kelly calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I used to be a preacher, actually, in the Word of Faith movement, which is the sponsors of the prosperity gospel. No longer am I there. But I guess one of the best ways to tell people about that is you mentioned the apostles, everything that happened to them, all the poverty, just read what Paul had to go through and all the failures he went through in life, and just read Psalms 107. And with people like that, what they understand is John 10:10. Thief comes to steal, kill, destroy, take away. I've come to give you life and life abundantly. So they take that to the supreme, and that's not what it means in the Greek by any means. Ephesians, the last verse, is actually better.
Yeah, it isn't material abundance, that's for sure, Kelly. Kelly, hang with me here for a minute if you can. I really want to know, because you've really got my attention here, I really want to know what caused you to shift from having been a preacher in the Word of Faith movement, preaching a prosperity gospel, to something else. That's got to be a great story right there, and I want to hear it. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I want to tell you, we got a huge responsibility right now as Christians, because there are millions of people in this country right now asking basic questions about life when they wouldn't have been asking them except for this crisis. And money is a barometer of our souls. And so there are a lot of people right now asking basic questions about life when they think they're asking questions about money. And I just want to encourage you to be there with a Christian answer, with a Christian worldview, with a Christian economics, which means be there with the gospel first and foremost in these conversations, because people are looking for hope. And if they're looking to you for hope in the economic sphere, you're going to be able to give them very little. But if it comes to hope that really matters, you can give them everything. You got to convert the question. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We were talking to Kelly from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Kelly told us that he used to be a preacher in the Word of Faith movement with the prosperity theology, but he isn't anymore. He said it distorts the gospel. Kelly, what happened to bring you to that realization?
Well, I went to Liberty University, and so I had a class with a man named Dr. Kanner. I don't know if you know who he is or not. So he's a former...
I know him well, yeah.
Yes. So anyway, I took a class with him. At the time, it was called Sects and Cults. It's now called Western Religion. So anyway, he's talking about all these cults of, you know, that you find in the Western Hemisphere of the world. So one day, he brought up how Kenneth Copeland and Kent Hagin are cultic. And, you know, I never liked Hagin, just for the record. I always thought he was kind of a little weird. I don't like him. But I did like Copeland. So I did go up to him and to Dr. Kanner. I said, hey, how come you call this a cult? He wouldn't really give me an answer. He said, I'll tell you what. For the research paper, I want you to study what the Word of Faith movement believes about Jesus Christ. So I did that. And I found many, many good resources. But honestly, I think the best one is by a guy named D.R. McConnell. He wrote A Different Gospel. And he makes the connection how Kenneth Hagin literally plagiarized off of a guy named E.W. Kenyon. And E.W. Kenyon literally plagiarized off of Mary Baker Eddy. So the Word of Faith is actually Christian Science. And they don't believe the same things we do about Jesus. They don't think that Jesus' death on the cross paid for his sins. That's why he had the hell and all these other things. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. They make it look like Jesus was rich. They ignore entire parts of the gospel where he offered up sacrifices and doves. That shows you're poor. So all that together, I was like, you know what, this really is a different gospel. It's trying to turn people into God through the words. That's not what Jesus wants, and I repented of being greedy. And actually since then, it kind of messed me up in a way, because I've been Christian, you know, 6 years now. So at the time, I was 3 years into Word of Faith, you know, as a new believer, I was into it almost immediately. So I had to rediscover the whole Bible all over again. And in the long run, great. You know, I understand it better. I can, relationships with people are better. My evangelism is more effective. I'm better financially, actually, you know, but not because of my belief, but because I've learned how to finance myself and take responsibility instead of just saying, oh, God's going to do it and sit back in a chair and do nothing.
Kelly, it was worth doing the program today just to hear you. And I just got to tell you, I reveled in that. And I'm just very, very thankful for that. Because so many things come to mind. First of all, My friend Ergun Kaner, who is the president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary, they are just used a model of excellent Christian teaching. And I'm thankful to hear that. And, you know, what a great thing he did, just to send you back and say, okay, track the sources, figure this out. Rather than me give you the answer to the question, you go find out for yourself. And boy, did you. God bless you for doing that. And I just want to trace that pedigree for just a little bit, because Kelly really took us through kind of a genealogy there, following it back. But if you go back to the early period in America, there was a prosperity theology that was kind of flirting around the edges there. I mean, you can find a little bit of it in someone like Benjamin Franklin and Poor Richard's Almanac. You know, a penny saved is a penny earned, but it's prudential wisdom. It wasn't a theology that was promising that the gospel means wealth. It was just an understanding that such things as thrift and labor and other things would lead to prosperity. But then in the 19th century in America, especially in the late 19th century, there came some developments in which there were people that felt like they hadn't received that promise. They had not received the kind of material abundance they wanted. And there were preachers that came along to do this. A lot of it was in what's known as the burned-over district of New York, where a whole lot of revivalism had taken place and a whole lot of promises were made that weren't yet being fulfilled. And so you had several cults and sects come out of that, which include Mormonism and would include the Jehovah's Witnesses and Christian Science, just out of that whole era. And, you know, Kelly, you're exactly right. You look at an awful lot of the teachings of Christian Science, and they work their way into a lot of this prosperity theology. In fact, there's a lot of just totally aberrant theology. It goes right back to the book of Acts, where you find Simon Magus trying to sell the things of God, the promises of God. And there's a lot of that there. And I got to tell you, the insidious part of it, and Lee Grady, who was the editor of Charisma Magazine, just the way he put it is better than I could put it. He said this: it definitely goes on that a preacher might say, if you give this offering, God will give you a house. And if you did get the house, people did think it was an answer to prayer, when in fact it was really bad banking policy. Now, he's saying that from within the charismatic movement, not from without, not from outside. Now, one of the things that I've tried to do in my article entitled "Are We Promised Prosperity?" found at my website today, I published it just this afternoon after Congress voted. I wanted to wait to see what happened and be able to report on it fresh. One of the things I try to bring out is that we should not look down upon and sneer at those who are entrapped within a prosperity theology, because in many cases they are there out of desperation. We just want better for them. We want them to know the authentic gospel. And as much as we're concerned for them economically, we're more concerned for them spiritually. But I also just want to give a word of humble warning to those who aren't even close to a charismatic prosperity theology. My fear is that in many cases we've kind of backed into a prosperity theology of our own, in which we just take prosperity for granted. And the true test of authenticity might be in a situation of want. You know, the kind of prosperity theology we've really got to worry about is one in which we suggest that we're promised prosperity in the gospel. We just aren't. And far more believers in Christ have been poor than wealthy. And I need to put it in the present tense. Right now, around the world, far more believers are poor than rich. And perhaps it's the rich, and that includes probably most of us, we bear the greater responsibility not to make the gospel into a lie. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I hope you'll read my article, Are We Promised Prosperity? It's found at my website at albertmohler.com. And I wrote it with what I hoped was both insight and a humble heart, because I am moved by the fact that so many Americans are in economic distress. And if we're not concerned about that, then, you know, frankly, we're just not responding in a Christian way here. There are an awful lot of people for whom, let me just say, the economic bailout plan in Congress is a pretty remote reality, because they're more concerned with meeting the mortgage payment. And I just want to give a word to churches and pastors right now. You know, one of the most important things that you may be called to do in the direct ministry of the care of your own congregants as a church over the next several months may be helping people who are in economic distress. And there's going to be a trickle down or a bubble up impact of this throughout a lot of churches and a lot of Christian ministries. We may find that there are people who simply are in economic distress, unable to give the way they'd once been giving. I hope that's not the case, but I fear it might be the case. I can tell you right now that the Boston Globe is reporting that Boston University is cutting back. It's declared a hiring freeze simply because it's afraid that too many of its students are going to need more and unexpected student aid, and they're diverting funds in that direction. If you just check the headlines, you're going to find that that most businesses right now are beginning to cut back on investment. A lot of businesses are going to be looking at a hiring freeze. Is this because we're entering Depression 2.0, as Niall Ferguson calls it? I don't think so. I think there's good reason to believe that kind of worldwide disaster can be avoided. I have to hope so. Ultimately, our confidence is in God, but the other reality is that when you write it small, you write the economy small, it comes down to where families and individuals are really trying to make ends meet. And this is where some basic economic principles are really important. The first two on-air callers to the program today received a free copy of my new book, Desire and Deceit, The Real Cost of the New Sexual Tolerance, out from Multnomah Publishers. And I hope you'll find help in this book as well. It's just a reminder that there is never a time when we're dealing with just one issue. There are multiple issues before us all the time, and as Christians, we are called to faithfulness, not just in one area, but in all areas. I hope this new book, Desire and Deceit, The Real Cost of the New Sexual Tolerance, will be helpful to you. And again, the first two on-air callers today received a copy of that book. Folks, we need to think together here, not only on matters of sexuality and economics, but on the entire battlefront of ideas we face. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. If we're missing something, tell us about it. If you see something we need to be thinking about and talking about, send it to us. If we make an argument that you think needs to be corrected, write us about it. This is the place for a conversation, not just with those who are able to speak on the air, but with all of you. I want to hear from you. Just write me at mail@albertmiller.com. Go to albertmiller.com and hit the mail button, and it will get to me. Back next week for intelligent Christian conversation. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmiller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.